Good day, everyone. This is March Twisdale, producer and host of Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, and I'd like to welcome you to my interview with Islander Delinda McCann. Hello, Delinda, and thank you for joining me today.
Hi, March.
So let's see here. Prose, Poetry, and Purpose is recorded in the studios of Voice of Vashon, broadcast at 11 a.m. every Saturday and Sunday on 101.9 FM KVSH and is available online 24/7 at voiceofvashon.org. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
I guess for talking about my writing, the most important thing to know is I have a background in social psychology. Mm-hmm. I worked with at-risk kids, and when you say at-risk, that's a really, really polite way of saying that you've worked with the worst of what humanity does to children.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that burns you out, and I was about ready to retire anyway, so that was when I started writing,
mm-hmm.
and have used my experience with working with children and the adults around them to work on my books.
And for how many, let's see, you went to college first, like got a degree, decided to have kids, and dove into working with at-risk youth? Is that sort of the order it went through?
Yeah.
And so how long were you engaged in like the academia world before you plunged into it on a familial level?
Well, I got my bachelor's degree and got out of school and got drafted into working with migrant workers' children.
Mm-hmm.
And they were at risk mostly because they didn't speak English.
Mm-hmm.
So I taught English as a second language. And when that project ended, I then went back for my master's.
Mm-hmm.
And so it wasn't really quite finished with my master's when I got into another project working with teens.
Mm-hmm.
Most of that turned out to be a grief support group. Most of them had lost a sibling or a parent.
Oh, wow. So that is intense work. So this is, what's the title for this area of work? Social psychology, or?
That's what my professors told me to call myself, as a social psychologist,
right.
A social scientist.
Okay.
Because I have enough credits in both sociology and psychology,
mm-hmm.
to get a degree in either one. And it was,
so when you were going to college, roughly what decade are we talking about? 60s, 70s?
I was bachelor's 64 to 68. Master's was 74 to 76.
Okay, got it. Now, in both of those decades, which schools were you going to?
I went to Washington State University and Portland State University.
Washington State University. That's on the east side of the state,
yeah.
Right? Okay. And what was it like at that point for people who were going to college? Was it something that was subsidized well by the government, or was it extremely expensive? Were people going into debt? You know, how does it relate your college experience to what people are facing today?
I don't think it relates. My first tuition check that I wrote was for $106. We could work for 3 months in the summer and pretty much pay our tuition, fees, books, room and board,
mm-hmm.
for 9 months of school. You
right.
know, I had some scholarships, but, you know, not a lot.
Right.
In the state of Washington, we had timber money.
Mm-hmm,
that
mm-hmm.
paid for a lot of our university schooling.
Right.
And they cut down the trees.
Right.
And so we lost a lot of our timber funding.
Sure, over time. Of course, trees don't grow as fast as we can cut them down.
Yeah.
Okay, I always, whenever I talk with people in their, they went to school in the 60s or 70s, you know, I like to check in a little bit on what their impressions were. I think that was during, it was during that same time that Bernie Sanders was going to college for free in, what was it, New York City, I think, or something like that. My mother and father were attending UCSB, which is this gorgeous, incredible campus in Santa Barbara, near Santa mm-hmm. Barbara, and, you know, virtually free, you know, subsidized housing. So they're married with a child, so it's married student housing and stuff. And just things are really different now. So I like to touch in on that a bit.
Very different, you know. I was... I had two older brothers in college. Mm-hmm. My father was disabled. My mother worked in a library. And together they had three kids in college.
Right.
And it was doable because, you know, we had summer jobs. And we had some student loans. Student loans were like 3% interest when we got out of school. And you could put your money in a savings account and get 5.5%.
Right.
And we really didn't like being in debt and wanted to pay those darn loans off. But it was expensive to pay them off because you can make more with interest. But I think it took us 5 years to pay off all our student loans. And that was mostly because we wanted to be saving money at 5.5% instead of paying off loans that were 3%.
Right. Yeah, of course. It's amazing because I've known Jalinda now for, I think, 2.5 years. And I am really looking forward to discussing some of these books. And in fact, if you ever go to the farmer's market, there's the Locavore Lit, right?
Yes. That's
the name of it. Right. Okay. So we have Jalinda and her daughter, Melissa McCann, tend to be the stalwart members who are almost always there every Saturday at market with Locavore Lit. And they very kindly not only share their own written works, but they offer space for anyone who's on the island to bring in their books. So do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
We love to have other authors come and hang out with us. Marilyn Cochran quite often brings her books written by her dachshunds. And she's got some wonderful adventure stories about things she's done with those dachshunds.
Yes.
We like to have featured authors, and quite often somebody will come by and do a signing, hang out for 3 or 4 hours. They don't have to stay the full time.
Mm-hmm.
It's nice if they do. The more authors we have there, the better.
Right.
And just about, every other week, somebody else who has a book almost ready to publish or has just published something comes by and says, "How do I get my books on this table?"
Mm-hmm.
And we say, well, you bring in your books and you put them down on the table.
Right.
And they kind of look at us like we have two heads. But that's what you do. You bring in your books and you put them down on the table.
So and what's your top seller?
My top seller has got to be Matik Surat, End of Empire.
All right. So you have a whole overarching theme and concept to this series. And this definitely relates back to some of your life experiences. Why don't you summarize sort of in general what you're hoping to inspire in your readers with this storyline?
This came out of that internet experience where I was working with people from primarily English-speaking countries. I talked to people in India, Uganda, South Africa, Kenya, Zimbabwe. Just learning their culture, not so much what they eat but how they interact doing business. And I was so struck that they would speak to me, but not to somebody with a doctorate because they felt they weren't good enough.
Right.
That struck me a great deal. So I mulled that over for quite some time. And the other thing that came out of this was I worked quite a bit with the Minister of Health in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of his term, Nelson Mandela wrote me a very nice letter thanking me for my work with fetal alcohol syndrome and for my support of his Minister of Health. I didn't think much about the letter. I mean, Nelson Mandela wrote me a letter. And I basically said, isn't that sweet? I read it to my husband and blew it off.
That's pretty awesome, though. So they must have really... So how does that tie in with End of Empire?
Let's start down here with Lies.
Sure.
Yeah,
go for it.
Because, actually, it's in Power and Circumstance
that
I bring up the idea that kind of an ordinary woman, through the power of the internet, can actually meet somebody with the stature of Nelson Mandela. And the little...
Very good point.
The little things that we do to help ourselves or our friends or out of desperation or because it's the right thing to do really can land us in some rather outlandish and unexpected places.
Sure, exactly.
And so now with Lies That Bind, so I started where this woman actually meets the president that she has had this email contact with. At this point, I should say, I have never, ever, ever had an affair with a foreign head of state. That part of the book is totally fiction.
Well, you didn't say it was an autobiography, so clearly it's a story.
Yeah. Well, you know, when I start talking about it, well, it is kind of based on the fact that, yes, an ordinary woman can come to the attention of somebody very prominent and important.
Right.
Based a lot on this woman going to this country and working with their orphanages.
Okay.
And in working with fetal alcohol syndrome and advising foreign departments of health about fetal alcohol syndrome, this was at the time of the AIDS epidemic. Many, many of these kids were orphaned. Mm-hmm. And so I was also advising the structure of orphanages and following a model of defining the children in the orphanages as being part of a family and trying to keep friendship groups together.
Wow.
And so that's in here is part of what I learned about orphans and orphanages. And
so basically we've got a 4-book series here, which is very interesting. Lies That Bind was written first. And then you went back and you took the main character that's in Lies That Bind and you went back and you wrote End of Empire, Birth of a Nation, Power and Circumstance. And those three actually tell the backstory in a way of that character.
Yes.
So right now you said, and so lovely people out there who are listening, all of you who have written a book and then later said, oh, gosh, golly, you know what? I wish I had done something a little different. You right now are in the process of revising Lies That Bind because you feel like you now understand the character better and you want to enrich the story?
Yeah. Yeah. It needs to tie back to the others in some of the people that I just mentioned vaguely in Lies That Bind. I know all about them now and why they were coming to the compound, to the president's office.
Right. And you said you're going to break it into, it is quite a, what's the word for it? Tome?
It's 800. It weighs 2.5 pounds.
Yeah,
so,
huge. It's sort of like it's like the stand, only much larger in its height than width. Yeah, right. So you're breaking that down into 3 books.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a trilogy.
Yeah.
That's brilliant. All right, folks, if you have ever wanted to write a trilogy, Delinda here is saying you can probably also do it. But I would imagine with lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of time and effort. How long have you worked on these books?
I started in 2010.
And wow, that's not that much time.
I had cancer at the time.
Okay.
And I kind of battled cancer from 2009 through 2013.
And I would assume you just sort of dropped a lot of other stuff off your plate.
A lot of stuff. Just, yeah. And I sat and wrote.
Yeah.
You know, I just moved out of my life and into somebody else's life because my life sucked. And these other people's, my imaginary characters, people's lives didn't suck
in the same way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They had hope. They were healthy. They could go ride horses or whatever.
Right. Oh my gosh. Yeah. It's so funny how often people I interview who have written the inciting incident in their life that causes them to suddenly start writing is oftentimes actually an illness or an injury or something that just plunks a bunch of stuff off your plate, tosses it off, and you're like, oh, I got all this extra space here, and I can't move around very much or whatever. So what am I going to do? Bam.
Yeah.
Do you write on a computer or in notebooks?
I use my computer.
Yeah.
I started using my computer with Lies That Bind. I had written short stories before. I used those in a notebook. I guess I did do some professional writing. social psychology stuff and birth defects.
So one of the things that we've talked about, and there's a writer's group on the island, and it meets every Sunday at 6 p.m. And so you and I met, I think, initially through your daughter, Melissa, yes? Or did you and I know each other before?
I think we probably met once before when we were talking about organizing writers on the island.
And so we've had, you know, we've met during the writers groups. We've seen each other at farmers market. But we've also had just other casual conversation opportunities sometimes. And you always amaze me, and your daughter. You guys always amaze me with the depth of knowledge, factual, concrete, detailed knowledge you have about all sorts of issues that children at risk face, that the rest of us have this blasé impression of something, and we really don't know much about the details. I think there's a lot of us have a shallow impression of, oh, fetal alcohol syndrome, bad. You know, it's like, that's about as far as it goes. It's like, oh, it's going to somehow mess you up. And then that's like as much as we know. What are a few things that you think are useful for people to know about as they go forward in life, either as an encouragement for them to make sure they're very careful about drinking alcohol while pregnant, or as an encouragement to have more compassion and respect for people who are either suffering from fetal alcohol syndrome or raising a child who is dealing with it? What are some things that you would put out there that you think would really help people? Like top three.
The first thing that we always say is there is no safe amount of alcohol that you could drink when you're pregnant. And what the ethanol molecule does when it hits the developing brain cells is it interferes with the brain, developing brain cells to migrate to where they need to be. And so basically it's like they've taken a knife down the center of the brain and it disconnects the right side of the brain from the left side of the brain. And we say there's no safe amount because any amount, you know, every molecule that hits that developing baby's brain will disrupt a cell. But we can't measure. We can't measure minute disruption. But
it would probably depend on what stage of development, because different cells are developing at different times. So, you know, I've met women who find out they're pregnant. Like, actually, for me, with my second child, I realized I was pregnant like 3 or 4 weeks into January, and I knew that I had had champagne on New Year's Eve. And I actually I don't like alcohol personally. Somehow have a great willpower. I literally can't stand it. It makes me uncomfortable. So I rarely drink. But, you know, I know other women who are like, oh, my gosh, you know, maybe they're heavier drinkers. And they're like, I'm pregnant and I spent the last 3 weeks at like 3 different parties or something. And they get really panicky about that. So, I mean, and then you had doctors for decades who were encouraging pregnant women to drink a glass or two of wine every evening. And then you got the Germans. What can I say? You know, Germany, hundreds of years, beer. And in Europe, they drank alcoholic beverages rather than water, because the alcoholic beverages were safer for you because it couldn't grow the bacteria and the water was going to basically kill you. So when we say there's no safe amount, at the same time, we're dealing with a planet that's full of humans who, the vast majority of them over hundreds of years, have come from mothers who were drinking moderate to large amounts of alcohol.
Yeah.
So how do we find like a balanced line between there's no safe amount, but you don't need to be neurotic and paranoid and freaked out?
Women, you know, I've had that question any number of times. Hello, I just found out I'm pregnant. I've been drinking. You know, what do I do now?
Right. Yeah.
And I fall back on, well, there's going to be some damaged cells. Fortunately, The developing baby develops more cells than they actually need. Mm-hmm. So you've got a little bit of protection there. And you just may need to be aware that as your child grows up, they may need a little more supervision. They may have a little more trouble in math at school.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll probably be able to keep up with their peers with a little bit of help.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But there, yeah.
Depending on how much. Like, this would be a mother who maybe has been drinking, like, on a daily basis.
The ones that would call us were usually in a pretty big panic because they had been drinking quite a bit.
Right, right.
And we always say, well, stop now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And whatever comes after will be okay.
Mm-hmm.
And my own foster daughter, that was her story. Is her mother didn't know she was pregnant. Then she didn't get into the doctor. This was back in 76.
Mm-hmm.
And the doctor at that point then told the mother, you can't drink. So, yes, there is a significant amount of early damage.
Mm-hmm.
But the parts of the brain that developed later after the mother stopped drinking are fine. You know, that prefrontal cortex, the front of the brain, is all fine. And that allows her to function quite highly, despite the fact that some of the central stuff in the back of the brain is severely damaged.
Wow. It is amazing how much we know now about things, how much we can. It's really fascinating.
Well, being able, the enhanced MRIs were a really big boon to being able to look at the brain and measure the thickness of structures and understand how the brain functions. So that's been a real godsend to understanding why this particular disability acts as it does.
Right. Right, 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 right. Which then brings us around to the question of, you know, how do we help and support these people? So the top two books you have here, I'm going to lean over.
Okay.
Let's see. We have Something About Maudie, and then we have Jeanette, A Story of Feminine Courage. And so these are standalones, right?
Yes.
All right. Okay. So I'm looking at Something About Maudie. And this one is, about 200 and...
It's a normal size book.
Yeah, 260 or so pages.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Excellent. Tell us a little bit about this.
Well, Maudie is a United Methodist minister. A Czech chose that profession for her because one of the things that irritates me in mystery novels is that you have a caterer or a housewife who keeps ending up with encountering dead bodies in mysteries, and that just is not realistic. However, a pastor does. And, you know, pastors are some of those people that see the worst of what goes on and hear about everything that goes on in town. And so being a United Methodist, I know a little bit about that church. And so I wanted a middle-aged professional woman. I prefer to write about women who are mature and women who make good choices, but life is rough.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what we have with Maudie. So there's a wee bit of mystery in there. And
It says back here on the back, this is after, there's this really great sort of first-person introduction by her. I like this part. This is really great. You never had a woman pastor, which, of course, is a piece of this as well, because many churches still won't allow women into the clergy, let alone one who had once been an actress. You barely tolerated my Porsche, my dress, my makeup, and my style of ministering. You didn't trust my son and couldn't understand why I didn't want you letting yourself into the parsonage when I wasn't home. But somehow he managed. So that's sort of her self-introduction of herself.
Yes.
So folks, this is, you know, Maudie. It might sound like an old-fashioned name, but she's not an old-fashioned woman. And then, So an account of what happened in her first year, it includes a flood, attempted murder of a young woman, a cheating husband, several natural deaths, two divorces, and so much more. bam. So, yeah, there's a lot going on in here.
It's a fun read. It's set in the Kitsap County. So,
oh, nice. Sort of local.
Yeah. Samadhi encounters some of the things that we encounter. And, you know, she drives over the Narrows Bridge when the wind is blowing, and it's blowing rain. And rides ferry boats.
Oh, yeah. Brilliant.
Yeah. Her Porsche, she has converted to electricity.
Oh.
I had fun with Maudie breaking everybody's...
And you started writing this after you got cancer.
Oh, yeah. That one's... actually, that one was after I was getting well again.
Wow. Oh, my... You are so much fun. Okay, keep going.
Yeah. Her
her Porsche is converted to electricity. Yay.
Yes. Yeah. My daughter describes Maudie's stories as being kind of a little bit like the Anne of Green Gables stories, in that you have a community full of interesting characters.
Yeah.
You know, kind of like Vashon. A community full of interesting characters who care about each other or not. And,
and she's new. So what I like about this is that she sounds like she's coming into a community that a lot of the people who live there already sort of know each other. They've got the gossip going. They've got you know, they've got all that. But she shows up with fresh new eyes, and they have to respond to her as a new person. So you get both the established entrenched community aspect, but then you get the new person's role.
Oh, yeah.
I love it.
The new person coming into a small community.
An attempted murder, so apparently... Oh, interesting. Yeah. Now, I want to know.
With that one, we get to attempt murder. Into some brain damage there, you know, that's...
Okay.
I like to have people with disabilities in all my books.
Well, does the young boy in End of Empire start with disabilities?
There's a lot of... Well, Jake does not.
Yeah, the main character doesn't.
But, within a few pages, his sister dies.
Yeah.
So... Yeah. But he certainly encounters enough people with all sorts of limits.
Absolutely, because he's living in a very challenging world.
Yes.
Now, is it... I read that a while ago because I was in an interview you last year and then life got busy. So is it actually a real-world country, or is it just similar to one, but it's a make-believe one?
What I did when I was making this country up,
yes,
mentally, I danced around the world.
Yep.
Grabbing customs from here and there, using a lot of my background in social sciences to talk about what happens when people are living in an oligarchy, which much of the world is.
An impoverished oligarchy.
Yes.
Well, yes, because or is he just in a poor neighborhood in the beginning?
There is a small middle class in his country.
Right.
But he comes from a native background. And, you know, the natives are more
second
looked
class.
Down on
yeah.
than the immigrants. You know, and they do have a social hierarchy in their country. And even the Chinese people that have come there have a higher status than the natives.
It's interesting. I had a real sense basically of, you know, India and China sort of combined, and a little bit of a sense of Africa. So that was just my takeaways. But I haven't had the opportunity to read Birth of Nation or Power and Circumstance and Lies That Bind yet. So I'm just speaking to the first book, which, by the way, it is about the first third of it, the main character is still a child. And then the last two thirds of it, he becomes an adult and begins to grapple with adult issues. So is it true that you are working on a rewrite of End of Empire that's designed for children that would be mostly about the first portion of its story?
Yeah, Adventures of the Matic Sewer Rat is just about ready to go to the publisher.
Nice.
You know, I just need to format some things up and can send that off.
Mm-hmm.
At the market, we have a group of little boys who come to our table and search diligently for anything that
a boy might want to read.
Right,
and
they've already read through the couple that you've got there from Karen Cushman, right?
Yes. Yeah. Will Sparrow, they've read. Yeah. And that's, you know, we really don't have it. So Melissa said, oh, take the first third of this and expand that out. So that's what I've done.
Nice.
I've talked more about his friends.
It's a fascinating character.
Yeah. And a fair amount of detail about him playing football.
Good.
Yes. Yes, Jake really was excited about getting to talk about his football because they won the national championship. And through the rest of these books, he has to mention to everybody that his team won the national championship.
Now, is this international football as in soccer?
Yes.
It reminds me there's a movie out right now. My husband saw it on the airplane recently, came home and said, oh my gosh, we have to watch it. It's called Pele.
Mm-hmm.
And it's based upon the life of Pele, and it mm-hmm. starts off in a good significant portion of this movie is all about the childhood.
Yes.
And, you know, how these kids, you know, where they got their amazing ability to, you know, play soccer or football in the way that they do. It's a great movie. And I bet if you were to watch it, it would remind you a little bit of the scrappy type of stuff that these kids had to do in your book as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Those are the types of stories that I was pulling from when I put this all together. Is in a third world country, a kid from the slums doesn't have many opportunities.
Mm-mm.
And for playing sports, they're certainly not going to be into tennis or golf or even swimming.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody seems to have a soccer ball.
Yeah, of course.
And some form
If not, you can make it. I think Pele, in the beginning, they would take old socks and stuff socks into socks until they had this big soft thing, which is why they could do so much work with it, and they could, you know, manipulate it in so many ways and stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah. The other sport that is common is some form of martial arts, some form of self-defense.
Sure, of course.
And so that's was his two sports.
In the book series.
Yes. So
And so, well, you know, for one second, for those of you who are just joining us, my name is March Twisdale. I am the producer and host of Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, and I am interviewing my fellow Islander, Delinda McCann, today at the Sunrise Ridge Studio, Voice of Vashon. And I want to take a minute to thank some of the people on the island who do what is necessary to allow Voice of Vashon to exist, and that is to give us support. And so KVSH programming is supported by Snapdragon Bakery and Cafe. They have pastries in the morning, vegetarian lunches, wine and music at night. And, of course, there's the casual and friendly atmosphere in Snapdragon on Vashon at the highway near the south end of Vashon Town. And then also, of course, we have John L. Scott that provides a great deal of support as well for Voice of Vashon programming. They especially help out. They are an underwriter, and they are, when you want to buy a house, you go to John L. Scott for the best people and the best results. So now, folks, we're going to dive back into the interview. I've only got about 15 more minutes about 15 more minutes left. And so I want to talk a little bit about Jeanette, which is another one of your standalone books. So Delinda, for those of you who are just joining us, has lived on the island for about 35 years and worked in the field of social psychology, while also her family was a part of that work as they had... How many foster children did your family help?
Three. One girl was 18 when she kind of moved in and started spending her holidays with us, and I was... stood in for her mother at her wedding.
Right.
One girl was 12 when she moved in, and the youngest one was 5 when she arrived.
And did all three of these remain foster children, or did any of them end up becoming adopted children?
I didn't adopt any of them. The two were not, older ones were not, it wasn't appropriate to adopt.
Right, right.
And the younger one had enough issues. Mm-hmm. With the brain damage that I didn't think that sounded like something I wanted to take the legal responsibility for.
That's a good point.
Yeah, children with brain damage, we don't have the supports in our society to take care of someone that has serious disabilities.
Right.
And so generally they end up in jail.
Yeah. It's really hard to come up with a positive outcome.
Yeah. And I didn't think I wanted to be legally responsible for something that was really the consequences of the way our society conducts business.
Right. Do you have any countries in the world? It sounds like you were helping Delinda create literally like the first website ever.
Yes. About so fetal alcohol syndrome. You know. Other people were selling things, but I had the first one on fetal alcohol syndrome.
Yeah. So this website was pulled together, and you became the intermediary in a way between a lot of people in, sounds like, third world countries or distressed communities that wanted to work with you rather than try to go directly to some of the university professors and stuff. So you ended up being really in this beautiful melting pot middle ground where you got to see it at both ends. Countries that maybe you learned great things from or got good ideas from, people who are maybe doing it better than other people in the world. Where are the successes?
Okay. The big success, Sweden. The identification was first discovered in France with Dr. Lemoyne. He described fetal alcohol syndrome there. Then the U.S. confirmed his description at the University of Washington, actually. Dr. Kenneth Jones and Dr. Dave Smith replicated Dr. Lemoyne's description. And then when the researchers in Sweden picked up that exposure to alcohol during pregnancy was a problem.
Right.
They started a big prevention program.
Right.
They started looking at supports. And because they do support their population, they were able to identify people that have the disability. And they just kind of turned the picture around. They have done the best for prevention. They have done the best for supports. English-speaking countries haven't done so well, being primarily in denial. And, you know, every now and then you get a...
By English-speaking countries, I mean, so like in Denmark, for example, almost everyone speaks English, but it's obviously not their main language because Danish is their main language. So you're talking about just then America and the UK? Because everyone else considers English a second language.
Yes, primarily. Yeah, India, the U.S., Canada.
Is English the first language in India?
Yeah, officially.
Wow, that's amazing. I didn't know that. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, South Africa. South Africa and Russia have done a good job passing legislation.
Right.
To help prevent excessive alcoholism.
Really, Russia?
Russia, South Africa has the best laws.
Okay.
Russia is second.
But
they have
does that
a huge
mean that they follow
problem.
Through on the laws?
They're doing okay with their legislation. They have the huge problem of a generational disruption in family structure. They have a huge problem with alcoholism. And I have to kind of respect what they have done from where they've come.
Right. Well, I mean, alcohol is a huge part of the culture in Russia, obviously. And then you've got just endless economic struggle and difficulty. Yes. So you get all the depression and all the frustration and all that. Yeah. Of course.
Yeah. So they.
How about Ireland?
For a long time, we had a lot of denial there. I did talk to a few people from Ireland when I was working internationally. The researchers didn't pick up on it for a long time.
Really?
And part of that comes with the Catholic Church that has said, you know, with them, drinking is okay. You know, you have less alcoholism, less fetal alcohol syndrome in among Muslims who don't openly drink.
Right. So that means being openly drunk is going to get you in trouble too. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So. And Mormons don't openly drink.
Right.
And so, you know, as researchers are looking at populations, yeah, they are not identifying it in those cultures right. where if there is any drinking, it's hidden. Where it's,
well, and in a Muslim culture, not all, but in many of the countries that actually base their government on Islam, they're also extremely patriarchal. So the males have a better opportunity, so to speak, to break the rules and get away with it. Whereas I'm pretty sure females that break the rules and get caught are dealt with more harshly. And fetal alcoholism doesn't come through the sperm, does it?
Technically, what we call fetal alcohol syndrome does not come from the sperm.
Right. It's damaged during in utero. Right.
Confirmed research that says that the alcohol molecule can tag onto the sperm. And it does cause some changes in DNA.
Interesting.
In the sperm. So, yes, we've always said it takes a healthy man and a healthy woman to have a healthy baby.
Right.
Yeah.
But still, I would imagine when we're dealing with the traditional form of fetal alcoholism, you're just going to have a lot less women that probably have access to alcohol those cultures.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So that makes a difference. And there's still a lot of countries where, you know, particularly in Asia, everything is perfect. Mm. Everything is always perfect. Nobody has birth defects. Mm-hmm. We don't have a problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's so... Right. We're hoping that maybe culturally they're saying, well, don't drink when pregnant, but they don't have a problem.
Right.
So
right.
That's one of those little cultural things that we deal with.
Okay, so let's look here. Where'd the book go? Here it is. Uh-huh.
Jeanette.
Yes. So we're going to talk about this book, and then I'll be reminding everyone of how they can come find you to ask you amazing questions about all of your incredible work here. Not to mention, what an inspiration. In 6.5 years, you have managed to write, essentially, and publish 6 books. They're about really inspiring content and the rich characters and elaborate stories. So for those people who really want to write and they just are questioning their level of confidence, I love having someone like you come in and prove it can be done.
Oh yeah. Yeah, and we've built a good support for beginning authors here on the island now with our group on Sunday evening.
Right.
Melissa,
if you're looking for a writing critique group that's not going to be mean, nasty, or full of lots of drama, we have it.
Yes. You know, it's in, you know, we will look at each individual author's writing.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes we'll discuss about things like the Oxford comma or what I call rabbit trails. How do you decide what to leave out and what to put in? You know, do we need to expand this? And that seems to be our biggest problem we all have is when to expand.
Right.
And when you're adding superfluous.
Yes. Content. Yeah. When to go deeper, when not to go deeper. And of course, then there's also what I like to chat about is how to develop your platform, which is some people just cringe at the idea because they have this old school concept of platform as being like what politicians have, you know, as some fake, you know, image that you're putting out there and you're selling yourself. But the reality is that if you are writing, then you have a story to tell. You have a message to give. Well, in today's world, number one job of an author is no longer to write the great book. That's actually job number two. Job number one is to find readers, to develop a way to bring your brilliant writing to the awareness of people who are, you know, just in a very busy world where there's lots of things competing for their attention. So I really like authentic platform development, where it's really not about a shallow layer of, you know, hi, everyone, buy my book. It's more about what can you do outside of the book that also expands the purpose, that you had for writing the book. How do you reach out to new people? Mm-hmm. So tell us about Jeanette, A Story of Feminine Courage.
Jeanette started out, I like to tell people that Jeanette's problem was that she married a cheating cowboy.
That's a problem.
Yeah. I'm an organic grower. I'm one of the partners in Calico Gardens, and I have the little flower stand down in Burton.
Oh, that's nice. I didn't know that.
Oh, you didn't know that? No, my little
very
flower
cool.
stand is there on the corner in Burton, and
awesome.
I'm passionate about growing healthy food, healthy products.
Right.
You know, you're not going to get cancer from my flowers because there's just
Mother Nature.
Nothing toxic
yeah.
associated with them from seed through harvest. I make my plant food for my cut flowers mm-hmm. is simply vinegar and water.
Mm.
You know, both. Yeah, well, the sugar in there.
Yeah.
I like the sugar.
Yeah.
But it's, I often even use organic sugar in their water.
Oh,
for their
you're
food.
Brilliant.
Yes. So there's just nothing toxic there. And I make more with my one little acre than mm-hmm. somebody who is growing corn.
Right.
In Eastern Washington.
Right. Right.
And so
it's amazing how
that
much.
Is what.
Yeah.
One of the things I learned with being a farmer is that as I started looking at what people do around the world, again, with my interest in India and contact with some of the people there, I started watching what was going on there.
Right.
Where they learned that with a 5 or 10 acre piece of property,
right,
well farmed, they can grow more food than you can with agribusiness.
Well, and especially with what's been going on in India with Monsanto
yes.
going in and you know all of the suicides as basically these people who had successfully achieved survival with a subsistence farming level and saving their seed were tricked into believing this storyline that they were going to do better economically if they would start buying seeds from Monsanto, blah, blah, blah. And it completely failed. And we're at almost 200,000 farmers have committed suicide,
it's
if
sick.
Not more at this point.
It's sick.
Yeah, yeah, because what do you do when suddenly you go from generations of economic survival and now you're so far in debt, your family's yep. destroyed? It's, yeah.
And that's part of the problem of what's going on in Jeanette.
Right.
You know, it started out, Court inherited his farm from his parents.
Mm-hmm.
And they had run cattle and farmed pretty much organically, just using their land as it was designed to be used.
Right.
And so he got the big bug that he could buy these genetically modified seeds, and he bought into the whole hook, line, and sinker of agribusiness, and it doesn't work. And I talk to people in Canada who've bought into this. It doesn't work for them. It doesn't work in Washington State. It doesn't work in Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't work in India. So they have that economic stress.
Right.
You know, Jeanette works in a library. She does have a little plot where she grows some flowers and vegetables. And so they have a little roadside stand. And that's what they live on. Because mm-hmm. with Quartz income, it either goes to buying equipment, repairing equipment, paying the taxes. They get a farm subsidy from the government, and that goes to buying more of the same expensive
right.
seed instead of being yield. So that's a lot of what I talk about in there.
Yeah.
And
I love the picture on the front.
And that's what destroys, yeah, that's what destroys their marriage.
Ah. Well, I like in the front here, there's a picture of all cornrows. And it says, under this, it's a quote from Paul Hawken.
Yes.
And it says, all is connected. No one thing can change by itself.
Yes.
Which is, especially during this, the political climate of this year, is a brilliant thing for people to remember. It's why each and every one of us is important.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
And then the first, just to give everyone a little bit of a taste here. So the very beginning, the first two lines of this book. When I think about how quickly my life changed, I still get disoriented. I got into the shower, a married woman, and I came out the rejected wife.
Yeah.
And it just, yeah, it's very, I like how you start off immediately. It's just boom, boom, boom.
And, you know, it's the story is basically how Jeanette put her life back together and the repercussions of Court losing his wife who had a paycheck.
Mm-hmm.
And health coverage and everything that right. goes with a regular job. And so it's, you know, the impact all the way through and the impact mm-hmm. on the community. And there's another mystery that runs through there. Mm-hmm. I love libraries. My mom used to work in a library.
I love libraries, too. They're my anywhere I go, if there's a bookstore or a library in the area, I will go spend time there. And coffee shops.
Yeah. So, yeah, Jeanette works in a library. And, you know, growing up with somebody who worked in a library, I became aware of what they have there, and mm-hmm. you know, libraries just squirrel away the most interesting information.
Oh, I know.
And so,
it's like treasure hunting to go to yeah, into a library yeah. or a bookstore.
So, in this particular story, yeah, they've squirreled away interesting information that can be used to convict somebody. So,
all right,
yeah. So, there's a mystery all around that, too.
I know. And you know, the true fact is that we could probably talk for another hour because there's so much we haven't delved into. But unfortunately, I'm out of time. I am running into loss of time with many of my authors lately. We're all just having so much fun.
It's been fun being here.
Yeah. So, Delinda McCann, thank you so much for stopping in and hanging out with me. Let's see. So, everyone who's interested in checking out your books or chatting with you about the writer's life can drop by the farmer's market on Saturday here on Vashon Island. But what about the people who do not have a chance to come to market or people who are going to be listening to this show in other countries? Where can they get access to your books? Do they look you up on Amazon or where would they find more information?
I'm on Amazon.
Right.
And because I publish through Lightning Sources, my printer.
Cool. Brilliant.
And I do have readers all over the world. Actually,
I know you do.
Lies That Bind has sold better in Africa
than
it has in the U.S.
Interesting.
And,
very
and then
cool.
I have a fair number of readers in India also.
Very cool. I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
I'm not surprised.
So, yes, I'm available everywhere.
Yeah.
You know.
All right. Yeah. So look her up. When you look up Delinda McCann, basically a bunch of options pop up there.
Yeah.
But the most recent one is DelindaLMcCann.weebly.com. And thank you so much for being on the show.
You're welcome.
My name's Marge Twisdale. You've been listening to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, where my guest authors share how they hope to inspire positive change in the world, one reader and one listener at a time. And now I will leave you with the inspirational and timely song, We Are the Many, created by musical activist Makana.
Ye come here, gather round the stage. The time has come for us to voice our rage against the ones who've trapped us in a cage to steal from us the value of our wage from underneath the vestiture of law. The lobbyists at Washington do gnaw at liberty, the bureaucrats guffaw. And until they are purged, we won't withdraw. We'll occupy the streets, we'll occupy the courts, we'll occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. I Our nation was built upon the right of every person to improve their plight. The laws of this republic they rewrite, and now a few own everything in sight. They own it free of liability. They own that they are not like you and me. Their influence dictates legality. And until they are stopped, we are not free. We'll occupy the streets. We'll occupy the courts. We'll occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. You enforce your monopolies with guns while sacrificing our daughters and sons. But certain things belong to everyone. Your thievery has left the people none. So take heed of our notice to redress. We have little to lose, we must confess. Your empty words do leave us unimpressed. A growing number join us in protest. We occupy the streets, we occupy the courts, we occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. You can't divide us into sides, and from our gaze you cannot hide. Denial serves to amplify, and our allegiance you can't buy. Our government is not for sale. The banks do not deserve a bail. We will not reward those who fail. We will not move till we prevail. We'll occupy the streets. We'll occupy the courts. We'll occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. We'll occupy the streets. We'll occupy the courts. We'll occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. We are the many. You are the few.